from WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Celebrated nature writer Rick Bass made a name for himself chronicling America's western wilderness. He's told the story of a wolf pack in Montana, caribou in Alaska, grizzlies in Colorado. He's written about life in northwestern Montana and deer hunting in Texas. Now, Rick Bass is out with a new book on a journey that took him way out of the American West. The Black Rhinos of Namibia takes us to the oldest desert in the world, the desolate Namib in southwest Africa, on the trail of an astonishing, endangered creature. This hour, On Point, Rick Bass, on the trail of the life of the black rhino. You can join the conversation. How do you picture the rhino, the rhinoceros, its habitat, its poachers, its future? You can comment at our website, onpointradio.org, or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Here's a little sound. A set of black rhinos grazing for food at a small, isolated green patch in a very desolate scene. Black rhinos in Africa, you can barely begin to see their size and their setting, but you get a little sense of them moving there. Joining us now from Seattle is Rick Bass, environmental activist, critically acclaimed writer, author of a fine shelf full of novels, short stories, memoirs, nature writing, including The Lost Grizzlies, Wild to the Heart, Why I Came West. His new book is The Black Rhinos of Namibia, Searching for Survivors in the African Desert. Rick Bass, welcome.
Thank you, Tom.
It's a long way from the Yaak Valley in northwest Montana to the southwest, nearly tip of Africa there, and Namibia. Just give us a little compare and contrast of your home setting in Montana and the desert you stepped into in Namibia, Rick.
Sure. You know, up in northwest Montana, it's more Pacific Northwest, kind of a rainforest in that very far corner of Montana, really green and wet and drippy, swampy, marshy, very lush. And then, of course, the Namib's one of the driest places on Earth, less than an inch of rain per year some years.
And in that setting, you describe a kind of basalt, if that's how you say it, desert there. I mean, just how old, how overwhelming. You describe it as nearly like the surface of the moon. But paint a picture for us of that Namibian desert.
I will. Yeah, thank you. The common description is lunar or Mars because of the redness of the desert. It's very flat. It's this sheet basalt flow, the oldest rock, surface rock that's been unchanged for 100 plus million years, sometimes 150 million years in places. And that sheet has eroded over the millions of years into spherical cobbles, fist-sized cobbles. And so as far as you can see, it's as if someone spilled out these red marbles, all pretty much the same size and all occupying almost every space available on that flat surface. It is not what our brains are wired to receive visually. It's fantastic.
And hot and dry and endless, and across that almost surreal landscape, you've got a lot of sort of metaphysical musing that goes on here in this desert, and we will come to that. But here across that picture, that desert, comes this enormous beast, creature, black rhino. Help us see that. You've had an experience that few of us have, Rick. We see rhinoceros, you know, in little school book drawings of creatures of the world. You were right there. What's it like when you spot one in the distance? What's it like as it comes closer?
Well, again, yeah, the flat, the your mind is wired for horizontal. There's just sky and flat desert. And coming from, you know, the green mountains, or in the winter, the white and blue snowy mountains, I'm still dazzled by all this heat, you know, 130 degrees, 140 degrees, 150 sometimes down in the basalt, and the redness. And then, you know, with the binoculars, you can see this tiny thing far away, this white shining thing, and it's the only life out there. And that's just what's so the eye really fixes on the one thing, and it happens to be the rhino. And then as it gets closer, it gets much larger eventually.
Size nearly of a battle tank, and we call it a black rhino, but it's not black.
Not at all, no. Good point. There are a lot of different theories about why they're called black, but they are definitely not black.
But it is huge, and it is fast. I wonder if you'd give us, if you'd be good enough, Rick, a little reading from the Black Rhinos of Namibia, where you write about your expectations.
Sure, yeah, you bet.
This is Expectations of Rick Bass as he heads to Africa in this very hot, dry desert corner where this huge animal lives in the desert.
I don't know quite what I'm expecting. It's big and vast, but the country below the country is even more so. And I think that in part this is my instinctive fascination with rhinos, or even the idea of rhinos, that they are not so much metaphor as reality, in their enduring service as ambassadors between this world and that, mute witnesses and, for all we know, judges to the brief scald of human history across this land. Existing unchanged for so long, 4 million years at least, on the oldest unchanged landscape on Earth, the Namib Desert has not so much blinked, geologically speaking, in its last 55 million years, so it is as if the rhinos might always have been present, pre-known and pre-formed in that other world, and were waiting only to be released, waiting to emerge, perhaps, as if resting just beneath some sun-baked hardpan, the erosion of which finally allowed the rhinos to step up and out and into the world. It is the genius of beauty to make a thing look easy when in fact it has been anything but. In the end, looking at a rhino, examining and considering it closely, I wonder what else could have developed out in this singular world. Of course this desert land had to sculpt a 3,000-pound, nearly blind racehorse with 3-foot-long dagger horns, capable of eating poisonous plants and going without water for days. The fit is astonishingly hard-gotten, with the story of evolution and natural selection, a tale of such power and glory, and always the finer twist of occasional mercy, that I sometimes wonder, no disrespect intended, how it would read had the Bible not given us the 6-day short version.
All of time, or a huge chunk of it, and this desert giving us the rhinoceros. Rick Bass reading there from his new book, The Black Rhinos of Namibia. You're willing to gaze out on them and kind of imagine a very special status there in those not too well-seeing eyes, judges to the brief scald of human history across this land, as if it weren't us sizing them up, but maybe if they cared to even take us into account, the rhino sizing us up.
Oh, that's so well said. I mean, it sounds kind of metaphysical, but in their presence and in that landscape's presence, it's a cliche, but you do recall powerfully that, oh yeah, we're new here. We've 180,000 years, whatever. We're really new, and we don't really have the fit down quite yet.
Give us the recent history of the rhino. There was a very large population. There became a very, very small population. When did that happen and why?
In the 20th century, there were as many as 100,000 rhinos in Africa, and then the poaching market just shredded them. The U.S.-backed war between South Africa and the communist Angola really put the rhinos in the crossfire. The border there was the heartland of the black rhinos, and their numbers dwindled to as few as 40 black rhinos right there in that borderland. And
everybody was slaughtering them to take the horn, to sell the horn, to make money, to make the war.
Exactly. Yeah, exactly. It was a really bad spot for the rhinos, and the conservation community came up with this incredibly simple and effective idea. Went out because these rhino horns would be being sold for the equivalent of a bag of flour, a bag of salt, a bag of rice.
By the Africans, whatever. By the local people doing exactly. The poaching to make money or to make a bag of flour.
Right, right. So it was kind of a simple solution to provide an economic incentive to protect the rhinos instead of kill them. They were very cheap to protect, just as they were very cheap to kill.
What was the economic incentive that they gave, Rick? How did that work?
The conservation community hired the poachers, the people who knew them best, who knew how to track them, to protect them now. And so they still carried their guns, but they were just protecting the rhinos instead of killing them.
And the numbers today, it was 100,000. It went down to maybe 2. Where does it stand today?
Back up in the low thousands to the point where they're able to relocate some black rhinos from the heartland where they developed this Kunene and Damara land region of the Namib and help them recolonize and distribute them farther.
We'll talk about how that works and what Rick Bass saw. In the reading that you gave us, you talk about, of course this desert land had to sculpt this 3,000-pound, nearly blind racehorse with 3-foot-long dagger horns. Okay, we're not evolutionary biologists, but what looks inevitable to you, or what did look inevitable about such a huge creature in this barren landscape to you?
Yeah, no, fantastic. it could get pretty wonky here, so I'll try not to go too deep into my mind and spin off here. But so there's this red desert with almost no life on it. Really, the only vegetation or the dominant vegetation is this toxic plant called euphorbia. It's, I guess, roughly reminiscent of our sagebrush in the American Southwest, but it doesn't look like sagebrush. It doesn't look like anything. It's this luminous green, ghostly green, pale green plant with all these tubes coming up. Each tube looks like a Medusa's hair or something rising straight up, kind of this dome-shaped giant plant, and it's incredibly toxic. Nothing can eat it. So why is that? Why? Well, if life is going to have something develop that is going to take those nutrients and redistribute them across the landscape, it's got to be a pretty specialized animal, and so the rhinos have to be very big to process this incredibly poisonous plant. It's kind of simple. And then from there, their feet have to be a certain way to navigate these cobbles. They do have to have some protection. Their eyes have to be dim because the distances are so great. Sight helps you not at all. Everything is perfect, but you don't realize it until you start thinking.
Sound there of a black rhino's grunting roar. We're talking this hour with Montana writer, nature writer Rick Bass about one blazing corner of Africa and the future of the black rhino. His new book is The Black Rhinos of Namibia, Searching for Survivors in the African Desert. They have been under a lot of pressure at a Senate Foreign Relations Committee meeting in May on the global implications of poaching in Africa. U.S. Senator John Kerry offered some startling poaching statistics.
According to the African Wildlife Fund, poachers have claimed more than 900 rhinos across Africa these past 3 years. Between 2007 and 2011, rhino poaching increased by 3,000% in South Africa alone. Black market prices for these commodities are surging, with rhino horn at times more valuable per ounce than gold.
An Asian market for rhino horn largely driving this. Off those horns go to Vietnam or Laos or China, you name it. But let's look back at history. It's hardly just that market, that desire that's driven plenty of killing in Africa. Here's a little bit from, this is Charlton Heston of all things, cold dead hands and his rifle. But reading here from Ernest Hemingway, Hemingway's love for big game hunting, the takedown of nature's greatest beasts was explicitly reflected in many of his musings on nature. This is from The Snows of Kilimanjaro, legendary Heston reading a conversation between Harry, a rider suffering gangrene stranded on safari in Africa, and his wife Helen.
"Hello," he said. "I shot a tommy ram," she told him. "He'll make you good broth, and I'll have them mash some potatoes with a clim." "How do you feel?" "Much better." "Isn't that lovely? You know, I thought perhaps you would. You were sleeping when I left." "I had a good sleep. Did you walk far?" "No, just around behind the hill. I made quite a good shot on the tommy." "You shoot marvelously, you know." "I love it. I've loved Africa. Really, if you're all right, it's the most fun that I've ever had. You don't know the fun it's been to shoot with you. I've loved the country." "Yeah, I love it, too."
I love Africa there from Hemingway. You don't know the fun it's been to shoot, but blame does get laid. In June, Kate Silverton of the BBC spoke with Great Britain's Prince William about the black rhino in particular. And in addition to calling for the illegal rhino horn trade to cease, Prince William voiced a message to those affiliated with rhino poaching.
"My message to them is simply stop. It's a message about educating people and understanding that when you buy that rhino horn or when you buy ivory, you are taking this from an animal that has been slaughtered for this decorative ornament you have on your mantelpiece or you have at home. Is that really what you desire and you think is right in the world?"
Rick Bass is with us. His new book is The Black Rhinos of Namibia. And Rick, we've got callers coming in. Let me go to Rita in Hampton, New Hampshire. Rita, thanks for calling. You're on the air.
Oh, hello. I'm on the air?
Yes, you are, Rita.
Oh, thank you very much. The thing is that I have been in South Africa in the Shlushlui Park, which is near the Kruger Park, and I saw four rhinos there, which is really, that park is really dedicated to the rhinos. It's not a big park.
And what did you make of the rhinoceros, the rhinoceri that you saw?
They look terrible. They look so dangerous, and we didn't go too close, believe me. I would rather go close to an elephant than to a rhino.
Oh, now, that's interesting in itself. Elephants have their own mystique, their own danger, I suppose. Yeah. And Rita, there you were so close. Rick Bass, give us a sense of the difference between how rhinos, the black rhino, rhinos are kept in South Africa and in Namibia, its neighbor to the west.
Yeah, no, great question, Tom, and thanks, Rita. These rhinos in Namibia, up in Damaraland in the Kunene region, are the largest population of wild, free-ranging rhinos that come and go without park boundaries, and that makes their vulnerability to poaching all the greater, and it makes the importance for having protective incentives and a culture of protection around them absolutely critical. These are rhinos that are behaving as rhinos essentially have for the last 5 to 10 million years since they've been here. They are not affected by parks and humans. If they smell you, they will try and run away. They're terrified of humans.
And is there a poaching threat here, and how does it work? Do you see lots of local people like out patrolling, rifle in hand, looking out for poachers? What does their sort of buy-in to the conservation idea mean on the ground?
Yeah, no, you don't see a lot of anybody out there. It's such a hard country. It's, you know, we hear a lot of cliches about poverty worldwide and poverty in Africa. This is, you know, I guess what they call sub-poverty. This is, you know, folks not worrying about day to day, but hour to hour. There's very little water, very little productivity. So the people who are fortunate enough to be hired to protect the rhinos and to track them and to gather data, you don't see them. And there aren't that many because there aren't that many rhinos.
We'll look at the rhinos. It set you off into kind of memory, some nostalgia, some thinking about creation in such a stark landscape. I wonder if you might read a little there, Rick, where you and Dennis are in the back of a truck heading out this dirt road kind of into nowhere.
Sure. Mike and Dennis and I ride in the back of a truck, following an improbable dirt and stone road that leads surely to nowhere. The futile legacy of either exploration geologist or a military trying to lay claim to that which no one else wanted anyway. The barren land unscrolls before us as if being created by the very act of our seeing, as if everywhere we turn our eyes, new landscape springs into being, unfolding as if from secret place within us. As if we have been blessed with powers of creation, was it once this way for a creator? And the effect is humbling and invigorating. The closest experience I have to it is only that of the imagination. It feels like what, as a child, I used to think it would be like to land on another planet. Mars comes easily to mind. And to wander around, lonely but invigorated, first seeing. It is an entirely different quality of loneliness, crystalline, brittle, and haunting, but not painful, possessing instead great wonder and beauty. And it makes sense, I think, in the presence of such stellar, lucid loneliness, for either a creator or the land itself to labor with extra care to fashion curious and unique responses to that loneliness, if not to fill the landscape with an overabundance of creeping, crawling, leaping life, a shoulder-to-shoulder abundance of it, then to at least work to make it, that life, extra interesting, and to fit it with extra precision into the challenging slots and crevices and opportunities, perhaps fleeting or perhaps enduring, on that landscape. Or so it seems to this first-time traveler.
Rick Bass, Homo sapien, taking on board rhino country there in his new book, The Black Rhinos of Namibia. Aaron's calling, Unity, New Hampshire. Aaron, thanks for calling. You're on the air with Rick Bass.
Hi, Tom. I'm on the air.
Yes, you are.
Oh, great. I love your show.
Thank you.
I'm a little nervous, but I'm calling. My grandfather, Lutz Rui, published a pamphlet in 1970 titled The Rhino's Horn, A Threat to the Survival of the Species, in which he proposed not only helicopter surveillance to protect the animals, but also anesthetizing them and removing their horns to save their lives, you know, as the lesser of two evils. noticing that the poachers never take the corpses of the poor animals, and actually auctioning them off legally to eliminate the black market. And I realize this is a really...
All the way back in 1970, he was trying to get on top of that. And what do you know about his interaction with the rhino, Aaron?
He was a zoo director. He was a conservationist. He built safari parks in the U.S. I know he was... This was a very controversial idea, and he was ahead of his time, I think, even in some of the surveillance of the animals, you know, perhaps paying potential poachers to actually protect them.
Instead of poaching, yeah, I mean, it's an issue that's been around for a long time, not on rhino time scale, but in human scale. Thanks for that, Aaron. Rick, I got a little clip here. This is the 1980s. I mean, this is getting back there. And here's a little bit of the TV show MacGyver on rhino poaching. In the episode, The Black Rhino, and here's Kate, the director of an animal preserve in Southwest Africa, reflects with the MacGyver on a brutal black rhino slaughter the two had just witnessed.
Kate, I got to tell you, that is the sickest, cruelest, most inhumane thing I've ever seen in my life. And for what? A few $100?
That's a year's wage for most Africans. Yeah, I want to hate the poachers, but I can't. It's the traders, the ones who control the market, who have to be stopped. They get over $15,000 a kilo for those horns. That's more than the price of gold.
There you go, more than the price of gold, and it led to a lot of slaughter then. A lot of ideas out there about how to deal with the rhino poaching. Rick Bass writes on a very grand and intimate scale about them and their setting. Rick, we've got a gentleman with us right now from Namibia, there in Southwest Africa. Simpson Urikab joins us. He is with the Save the Rhino Trust in Namibia. Joins us right now from Korihas, Namibia. Mr. Urikab, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you. Good afternoon. Good morning, listeners.
It's great to have you here. You just heard, or you may have, one of our listeners calling in and saying in 1970 her grandfather was talking about, you know, maybe sawing off the rhino horns so the poachers would not come after them, or developing a legal trade in rhino parts to stop the illegal poaching. What about ideas like that, Simpson? Are they still out there?
Yeah, we had that idea. So we try and dehorn rhinos in the 1989 and 1991. It worked well. The horns grow back. Some of them are still there. They had calves. But we had so much criticism from the outside world saying that rhinos without horn is not really a rhino. And I also believe that God made you to have a horn. Now, someone cut your horn off. Does it mean anything to you? But we have put some other method in place to protect the animal and not just dehorning it. And even though if a poacher finds a dehorned rhino, he will kill it to make sure that he don't waste his time again on following that animal.
Rick, what do you make of that? I mean, people have looked to extreme solutions, even poisoning the horns, so if they were ground into powder, they'd be a threat to humans. But you've seen them there in their environment. What about the idea of taking the horn away to take the economic lure away?
Oh, sure. Hey, Simpson, good morning. It's great to hear your voice again. Thank you for being on the show. You know, this is just my opinion, which so many people have worked so long. Aaron's grandfather, you know, what I really applaud the engagement and creativity to raise the discussion and dialogue and get the issue up. My personal feeling is what I thought I heard Simpson addressing. If you're having to cut the horns off, then it's not a rhino anymore. It's something else. And maybe the antidote, there's got to be another solution. And it just may be lots of big wild country where it's really hard for humans to catch up with them and kill them. That's certainly what one of our iconic species in the American West requires for survival, really twofold element of a culture that is more accepting of their existence and big wild country where they can take refuge and be safe from our destructive qualities.
Simpson, there in Namibia, doesn't the rhino need that horn to protect, if not itself, then its young from, I don't know, hyenas or whatever else lives in the Namib?
Yeah, they do. They do need to protect themselves, and they also use their horns to rub the trees out. And some of them use them for rubbing trees out and eat and browse onto them. So the horn is really needed for the rhinos.
How do the local people look at the rhino, the black rhino, today? There was a time, no doubt, when they or some of their parents, grandparents, poached. How do they look at the rhino now, Simpson, in Namibia?
Yeah, surely. I mean, in the old days, people used to poach rhinos, but they didn't really poach them for selling the horns. They poached them for the bulk of the meat. But then there was no education. And then it came in the way we actually educate the people and give them the rights to benefit from all the other wildlife, including rhinos, through tourism. And people have realized that rhinos are really a national asset for them and also a proud for them. And therefore, people have changed their attitudes and they really look at the rhino as their own property and they looked after them. And if you really involve communities who are living around the rhinos into rhino conservation, then I think you have made a success of the whole thing. And that's where it comes, that where our government actually create the conservancies where a group of people living in the area has got the rights to benefit from wildlife within the area, whether they're selling them on trophy hunting or shoot and shell or for self-use, it doesn't really matter. But the fact is still that they benefit from them and they will look after them.
Can you trophy hunt the rhino in Namibia?
Yeah, we are, but it only happened once already. It's not a big business that's running, actually.
I mean, I know so people still like to do it. We saw the King of Spain, where it was hunting elephant in Botswana, and what was it, Donald Trump's son somewhere in Africa hunting leopards. But I wasn't picturing trophy hunting for this relatively small number of rhino. What about when you see them, how near do you get, Simpson? They're majestic creatures. They can also be dangerous.
Yeah, they can be dangerous. You need to treat them with respect. We know that the population that we're talking about now, the Kunene population, is the key one species population, and we know them really very well. We know more or less every rhino by name, by ID, and we know how to handle them. We know the ones that's very nervous, that the ones that don't really want people close to them. You can get close to a rhino, but if you get close to it, you can even disturb it, and the disturbance factor is the biggest thing that we don't really want. We don't want to disturb them because, as Rick mentioned, they live in a vast desert, and if they run, they can run for long distances, and if there is little calves, they can even die from dehydration. So we don't want to disturb them, so we keep the distance, a safe distance, that they don't really know we are there.
Rick, did you pick up on the pride of the Namibians these days in their rhino population?
Certainly the pride, but also, as Simpson was saying, it is the new way of business. The entire community benefits from the more rhinos there are, the more economically secure the conservancies are.
In comes tourism, in comes a cash flow. Simpson Urikab, joining us from Korihas, Namibia today with the Save the Rhino Trust there. Mr. Urikab, thank you very much for joining us.
You're welcome.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour with Montana writer, nature writer Rick Bass. His new book is The Black Rhinos of Namibia, Searching for Survivors in the African Desert. Here's a young black rhino trying to climb over a fallen log. Flies buzzing, a couple of legs over the log, snorting, squirming. Just a little bit of rhino sound there. He's back from Namibia, joining us today from Seattle. What's your question for Rick Bass on the Namib Desert? It's black rhino, the look and feel of the rhino. Will the rhino survive us? Will we save the rhino? Rick, your prose is so distinctive and special. We should read a bit where you get close to, there's several moments, but there's one time you're close to this rhino. There's a calf nearby. You're watching her. She's kind of, to the extent that her vision allows, watching you, certainly aware of you. Could you read for us?
I sure will. I'm out here in the desert with Mike Hearn, a rhinobiologist associate of Simpson, who've done incredible work elevating the importance of rhinos in the region, and then a biologist in a Sizemore. So, the rhino's coming up on us here.
And your trackers.
Yes, Leslie and Joseph and Himba. Mm-hmm. There's a small group of us here.
Mm-hmm.
In our new space of fear and beauty, we were able to observe her in a way we would not otherwise have been able to. Everything is revealed here at last, and I find myself astonished by each individual part of her, as well as by the greater whole that stands before us. Her eyes are filled with intelligence and with anger, but not quite menace, though too she appears to be possibly considering or building toward menace. In our suspension, there is time to note the bristles at the end of her tail, like those of a horse's, and the strange curves and articulations of her bowed legs. In from the shoulder, toward the top of the knee, then sweeping out from the knee toward the ankle, and then back inward yet again at the tops of the huge and all-important, all-durable feet. Out on this landscape, her strange toes do not look strange, but instead perfect. The horns, of course, command her obvious and immediate attention. But what I find myself observing most closely about her is her color and musculature, particularly her front shoulders, which support so much weight. I had assumed, from everything I'd always heard, that a rhino was armor-plated, segmented as if with scutes and scales like a great reptile, even a dinosaur. But staring at her now, I find her to be swathed in muscle, not armor. Her skin appears creamy, with the detail of musculature one might expect in a classic marble sculpture. Michelangelo's David comes to mind. And the horizontal sunlight heightens the details of the musculature even while softening the tone. She is brilliant, luminous, and she is made of muscle, not scales or stone. Mike is watching her most closely of all, in that same mesmerized state of rapture, yet I see no fear in him, only joy and wonder, leavened with concern for the rest of us, in case things turn ugly. And as the mother rhino's musculature tightens and she cants her head that 2 or 3 degrees to the left, fixing on us now, Mike senses the coming charge and says, "Okay, stand up, but stay together, and back up slowly."
Back up slowly in the face of a creature that can run 30 or 40 miles an hour across that Namibian desert. The Namib, Rick Bass reading there from the Black Rhinos of Namibia. Rick, your fans are legion, rhino fans too, many calling in. James in Middlebury, Vermont, you're on with Rick Bass.
Hi, Tom. Listen, I'm no specialist in rhinos, and I don't want to put myself against the people who were speaking, but we were in... We were in Botswana about 5 years ago on safari, and we saw a lot of animals, no rhinos. So we went up to Zambia because there was a park where there was a black rhino, and we paid a guy, and we got in his little Land Rover, and we drove around looking and looking and looking. We knew there was a black rhino on this reserve, but the guide couldn't find him, and I kind of wondered why he couldn't find him, but it was a big place. And suddenly, we did find him, and there he was, and he was... He was accompanied by two soldiers carrying, like, assault rifles or something like that. And mm-hmm. they waved us over. They couldn't have been more friendly. And they said, "Come, come, come right over." He's totally tame. We stood with this rhino. We took photographs of him with our children sort of leaning on him.
This is a live, rhino in a stupor?
A live black rhino. He was the size of an SUV. And everything that I had ever heard about the black rhino, about how dangerous they are, again, I'm not a specialist in rhinos.
Yeah.
And we did this, and the guards, of course, were very keen to get paid.
Of course.
They had their hands out.
Hey, James, let us pick it up right there if you'd be kind enough. And thanks for that story. Rick, what do you make of that? I mean, maybe none of us are specialists here, but a black rhino you can just go up and touch under the chin?
Yeah, no, Again, the comparison between grizzlies in this country, it's so important to have big, wild country where these species can be free-ranging and behave as they've evolved and as they are meant to behave, rather than being accustomed and acculturated to serve us. In my value system, it's really, I'm not judging anybody for going up and tickling a pet or tame rhino on the chin in a park, but... or one that's accustomed to people. But what has value to me in this world is such an incredible animal as a rhino that if it smells you, it runs And you need a lot of country to accommodate such a wide-ranging and fearsome creature.
That's the free way, the free world that you saw. But James, thanks for that story. Nancy in Charlotte, North Carolina, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom. I was just wondering if perhaps the people who are trying to save these rhinos could spray their horns and make them useless to these poachers, like Greenpeace did starting in the 70s with the little baby seals in Canada. They would just spray their fur with a non-toxic spray, but yeah. It made their pelts then, undesirable.
Well, of course, it's a little different because it's the horn often ground into powder. That is the end product for a lot of this. But what about it, Rick? And more broadly, you know, whether humans, in your view, having spent some time there, will end up extinguishing or saving this species?
Yeah, great question. And thank, you know, all the callers for your concern and creative ideas about how to protect the lives of the rhinos. I don't mean to sound callous or cold-hearted, but my own greater desire is not to protect the lives of the rhino, but to protect the essence of the rhino, to keep them being rhinos. Again, as Simpson said, they have these horns for a reason. If we start having to spray paint them or poison them or cut them off to save them, we haven't saved them, in my opinion. The way to save them is, in my opinion, is to allow them, accommodate them, this vast space in this incredibly wild and harsh desert where they can just keep on being the way they have been for 4, 5, 10 million years.
You know, we've got reviews of your book where reviewers are very skeptical that your optimism is ultimately merited. You know, people have come to adopt an attitude. Here's one reviewer saying, come on, get real, Rick Bass. They're going to be gone one way or another. Look at the world as it unfolds. What do you say?
Oh, well, you know, the reviewer might or might not be correct. Time will tell. But I think it's a question of dignity and morals. Do you fight for what you love and believe in, and do you accommodate other species and other life forms a right to fit the world, to continue fitting the world, when we ourselves, I think anyone on would acknowledge we don't really have our own fit in the world down quite right yet.
Joe in Livingston, Tennessee. Joe, you're on the air with Rick Bass.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
And hi, Rick. Thanks so much for letting me speak. I actually met Rick, met you about 10 years ago at a symposium at Tennessee Tech University that my wife helped organize, oh. And you spoke there. You were one of the keynote speakers along with Al Gore, and we really enjoyed that. In fact, about the end of June, we took a drive up through the Yaak Valley just to see where you live. We've been reading your books for a long time and really enjoyed the drive up the Yaak Valley, although we were kind of disheartened by all the clear cuts that you've written about so eloquently. And I was just curious as to why you're changing your focus from the U.S. To Africa. In fact, we found out that when we were in Missoula that you were on a trip to Morocco at the end of June,
July. Yeah, actually, Rwanda. Yeah, thanks, Joe. Mm-hmm. Good to hear from you. I'm a board member of this conservation group called Round River Conservation Studies, which with Simpson and a nonprofit in Namibia called Save the Rhino Trust has been gathering data for rhino conservation biology, and Round River had asked me to go over there and help them with the program. So that's how I became engaged.
And out you go with some interesting kind of rumination along the way. I mean, you say you right at the front, you've been apprehensive, had been, about traveling to Africa. But yeah. You've come to see that the world is Africa, that the rest of the world, you know, which came from Africa, is becoming Africa. Again, what do you mean by that?
It's couched with quite a bit of caveat, not wanting to sound disrespectful, because Africa's woes are kind of the in many issues in many places the high end of the amplitudes of the human condition, the the challenges, but just the physical logistics often of living. But as cultures around the world struggle, collapse, fray with what seems to me increasing frequency, it's making a lot of people who previously believed a lot of peoples who previously believed themselves to be either superior or indomitable or secure, less so. And that's, I think that's going to be humbling for many hundreds of millions and billions of people.
Rick Bass writes, we are turning to Africa not with quite so much colonial patronizing, but with greater respect, partnership. He says, Africa, after all, survived, while many in the United States, exponentially less tested, are already buckling and fragmenting, falling apart at the seams under some of the pressures we're facing. Dan in New Orleans. New Orleans, Louisiana. Dan, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Hi, Rick. I also was actually in Yaak Valley about 12 years ago. I was young, just had graduated college, driving across country and reading your books. And I stopped in Yaak, and a wonderful, really nice German man whose family was he was homeschooling them, and they really lived off the land. He was kind of a local timberman, but he made a very big point of telling me that he was a selective logger. And I helped him cut some wood and deliver it to your house, in fact.
Yeah.
And he told me about, I think one of your dogs had recently met his demise, possibly at the hands of some of your neighbors who didn't agree with your environmental politics. And I was very keenly aware of that kind of element of, you know, I felt out of place, and I was camping, and I felt a little scared. And
with the political conservatism of
look at me, mm-hmm. and see that I might be some kind of environmentalist or something. And now today, our politics is even so much more polarized and acrimonious today. I'm wondering if it's affected your life there, and in general, does it change or affect your outlook on global environmentalism or America's involvement in global environmentalism?
That's kind of a big question. Thanks for calling in. Yeah, you know, short answer is you know, all politics is local, and these conservancies that Simpson is working with in Namibia and the small watershed community groups up in the Yaak that we're working to help protect wild country. There are always solutions to these resource wars or any kind of political strife. But there has to be a willingness on the part of the participants to come up with solutions. And you're right, we don't see that in a lot of the high moneyed you know, upper levels of government where these wars are being fought for ideology and Supreme Court positions and such. It's really hard to get together and come up with solutions at that level. But in the community levels, I still have a lot of optimism.
And with all that, you ask a pretty big question in the book as well, Rick. You ask, what is the individual's duty in a time of war, ecological and otherwise? What did you come away from the Namib thinking about that question?
You know, two things, and I think it's what people who've asked themselves that question on anything, eventually where you settle out, they think some war seems unwinnable, some war seems daunting, some issue, some situation seems hopeless. Well, maybe it is, maybe it isn't, but still, I mean, do you quit or go on? I think bearing witness, you know, to the beauty of the world is important, and that it's disrespectful to do otherwise, and inhabiting that moment with as much gratitude and appreciation and awareness as you can muster seems to be kind of a dignified response.
As you looked out on these huge, amazing creatures in this barren desert landscape, there's a lot of meditation in this book on evolution and the divine. Share a little bit of what that setting inspired in your thinking.
Again, I think it comes from when you're out in a situation like that, it's a cliche to say, but you do have things stripped away. You have your perceptions about yourself, or perhaps even your absence of perceptions about yourself, stripped away. And you start asking why to everything. I mean, not just why am I here, or why are humans here, or why are humans the way humans are, but why is that acorn shaped like it is? Why is that grain of sand larger here in this sediment flow than why is the clay here? Why is the sand here? Why are the stripes of the zebra this way? So there are all these why. Some are answerable, some are unanswerable. But at the very bottom of it, and Cormac McCarthy writes about this so eloquently, about that fire that's in the human condition, in the human soul, that candle, that spark, that fire, you know, the fire keepers, the fire carriers. Why is a thing in us to ask why? A lot gets stripped away, and a lot gets comes up from beneath the surface. And that's the value of wild landscapes. It's the value of big, empty spaces, I think, or one of the values to us.
Why is the rhino there, Rick?
I don't know.
Sure is amazing, though. Sure is amazing. That description, you said it doesn't look armor-plated. You had anticipated it would. I've often had that same thought. But you say, no, it's just big, rippling musculature.
Yeah, totally powerful animal, which is what's required to navigate that landscape.
And off it goes, in the mind of its own. In Namibia, Rick Bass' new book is The Black Rhinos of Namibia, Searching for Survivors in the African Desert. Rick, it's great to have you back. Thank you very much for being with us today.
Thanks for having me back, Tom.
Listeners, thanks for joining us. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.